this moment. You just introduce yourself.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Andrea Hewitt, and I'm the newest PA, Program Associate with the Improving Healthcare Systems. I'm happy to be joining the team. Prior to coming onto the team, I was with the Pew Charitable Trust, and I have a background in public policy and also research background in public health and then chronic conditions especially. So I'm happy to join you all. Good morning. Thank you.
And again, I just want to publicly really thank Leah Full Marshall for her willingness to attend the meeting today and yesterday and stay with us for the entire meeting. It was very, very helpful for all of us to hear her perspectives. Okay, the next topic is the intimate partner violence topic. If you recall yesterday, we talked a little bit about our decision to hold this off for prioritization topic so we had a chance to address with the board. And I just wanted to clarify yesterday that, you know, the decision to hold this off was really my decision, okay? It was really my decision in discussions with a board member who I really respect, who was really questioning, you know, whether this kind of social issue is really within our mandate to do it. And unfortunately, given the holidays, there really wasn't a lot of time to do a lot of vetting on this process. So I thought it was extremely important for us to come back at this meeting, put the topic on hold, hear your thoughts so that we could have a more meaningful discussion with the board. And this also reflects my commitment over the next year to really get complete alignment between what our improving healthcare system's agenda and priorities are with our board priorities. And just as an example, there were issues that have been raised about, you know, should we be involved in high-deductible health plans? What we did is we held a workshop with ARC, and we're going to be able to put that material together so that we can have an informed discussion about those kinds of issues to see, you know, exactly where some of the boundaries should be for where our program is actually serving PCORI's mission to its fullest. And that is a major initiative of mine in the coming year, and it's one reason that motivated kind of holding this back so we could have a discussion around an issue like this. I just want to say that, you know, that we received your feedback on the topic, and we do plan to try to work out a way to have a dialogue with the board members. You know, from what I heard yesterday, I think the key issues surrounding the topic that we need to share with the board include the following. It was clearly reflected by all of you that this is a high-priority topic. It's clearly patient-centered. It is in the media, and many of you thought that PCORI was the right funder to address this particular issue. I think panelists expressing all stakeholder perspectives voiced their opinion that this probably should be a high priority topic for the Improving Healthcare Systems program. There are interventions in practice, including multidisciplinary approaches, which could be compared to address some key evidence gaps in this area. We also heard this is really a primary care issue, so it's directly focused in the healthcare system. And which we know is obviously considered a real systems issue. We heard from Amy the timing is right for this topic. The upcoming issues of the Journal of Williams Health, for example, that's solely devoted to this topic is probably a great way to further refine our understanding of at least the gaps in research and maybe interventions, not knowing that the actual scope of what they're going to cover in that issue. And it was also reflected as a very important topic for purchasers and employers. And I don't think this was reflected in the topic brief, but Leah Binder mentioned that, you know, it's a leading cause of homicide for women in the workplace, which I didn't know. And I think also from the perspective of the panel, it is a delivery system, as frontline clinicians are often tasked with working out these issues with victims of intimate partner violence. And others noted while there's a downstream issue about, you know, do you really have the resources and things to refer people to, and that gets to the whole thing about, you know, whether we can really come up with good comparative effectiveness research questions. The question of the topic, though, I think the panel has really, I've heard from you that you believe this is appropriate. And so overall, we realize there's a lot of support of this issue around the table, and we will have initial discussions with the board subcommittee to pursue whether, again, this is the kind of issue which everyone recognizes is an extraordinarily important social policy issue in this country, whether this is the kind of topic for our program that's appropriate, given the direction that the board sees in terms of how our program gets focused in the next 5 years. And again, I just want to say we really appreciate your flexibility, all your feedback, and understanding as we kind of work through this process. Did I miss anything in terms of the kind of summary from what we discussed yesterday?
Yeah, this is Ann Sales. I just want to add, and it may be my personal perspective, but I think there was agreement among the panel about this, that there are conceptually strong links between the suicide topic and the intimate partner violence topic. And I don't think we have any disagreement that the suicide topic is highly relevant. It is a systems issue. And it has many of the same concerns that you very appropriately raised about downstream, whether or not there are, you know, effective referral mechanisms and other things. But I think, to my mind, there would be a huge disparity in not addressing one but saying that the other one is high priority. So I think that's important also to put into the discussion, because I find the two not that easy to separate. And I'm thinking actually clinically here. I'm thinking about my time as a clinician. But I'm also thinking my role on this panel is as a caregiver family advocate. And I'll just say that we had an experience of my husband's best friend committing suicide that was very personal, very real, and we were right there when his body was found. And it was really a very tough experience, as you can imagine. As a person speaking, you know, for that group of people who are affected by this kind of thing, I think everybody involved in the investigation and the community dealing with it would recognize that there is a health system issue to it. So I just want to say that very, very clearly.
Steve, I'm just looking through my own notes. And one of the things that was mentioned yesterday that I think is important to put in your on your list of reflections as well is this. It was brought up that perhaps this is better for the Addressing Disparities group, and the advisory panel, I think, makes a very good point that to look at it through the lens of disparity seems to make it a gender issue, and that it was not a gender issue. It really was more cross-sectional in that. So I wouldn't want to move that, because I personally think moving it to the Addressing Disparities is not the next best step for this particular topic.
Go ahead, Alan.
This is Alan.
Oh, let me give Annie first and then Alan.
Well, no, it's the New England Patriots thing. That's
going to have to get over that one.
You're never going to live that down.
Love my cat. My question is related to the work group that you mentioned earlier for the Hep C. You pulled together a work group. Can you just say a few things about who and how you decide to pull a work group together, and seeing how it might have worked out for Hep C? I do wonder if IPV would lend itself to a work group, although I do feel the Journal of Women's Health is going to be extremely helpful.
Well, I don't know all the intimate details of exactly how the generation of this, and I know, Woody, if you know that as well on the very front end of exactly how that got going, but I do know that there clearly has been a considerable concern about the nature of these particular therapies, which are extraordinarily expensive, and that a recognition that there was research that needed to be done to really inform this area, both in screening and trying to look at these drugs head-to-head, as well as the issues of, you know, watchful waiting versus, you know, getting the drugs, as well as some delivery issues. And it was considered so, you know, compelling at that point that there was an outreach to many of the key stakeholders, and they agreed that this was a very important and timely issue for PCORI to address. And so a work group was pulled together to try to elicit those questions. And get a sense of, you know, the relative priority from the groups that attended that workshop. And that resulted then in the decision to move forward with a targeted funding announcement.
I wonder if that same fourth, Matt, if need be considered for the topic of IPV.
Alan?
I just want to come back to the intimate partner violence issue. I appreciate very much your summary description of what you plan to present, Steve. I thought it captured all the right elements. And I agree also with the comments and suggestions that were made by Ann and by Doris. But I'm a little concerned by how the unnamed advisory board member characterized the issue as a social policy issue, because I think it, but it's not just a social policy issue. No one deserves to be the victim of violence, regardless of gender, age, whatever characteristic. It seems to me it's a health issue, not just a health systems issue, but a health issue. Everyone's entitled to health and well-being, and it just seems to me that this should have high priority, and I would hope that that could be conveyed to the members of the advisory board, that it is as much a health issue as it is a social policy issue.
And I was hoping to try to convey that in what I was getting from all of your comments in terms of my remarks, and I'll try to be sharper with that moving forward. Thank you.
Are there any other comments? Again, we have a short morning, so... And as always, I know I'm sometimes a slow thinker. Get home, I say, oh, darn, I wish you would have said that. So I don't think Steve's going to rush out tomorrow morning, Saturday, and talk about this issue with others. So if you marinate on this and come home and have an idea or two or a comment that you still want to make, just don't hesitate to shoot it off to staff. And we'll be sure in our April meeting to follow up. And those of you who are rolling off the panel, you know how to find folks. So don't be shy, as I really hope you won't be. A little encouragement, no encouragement really needed there, but truly just follow up on this issue. I don't think it's going to disappear, which is exactly what should happen, and we'll see where it is in April or whenever we get together next.
Okay, now we move into the other business of the day, and that is the outcomes of the reprioritization survey. Again, reminding people on the phone, we went over four main topics yesterday, and we had an opportunity after extended discussion for members of this advisory panel to re-vote and reprioritize those topics based on the benefits of the extensive discussion we had yesterday at this meeting. Now, Lauren, are you going to, since you were the one, or are you going to do it, Penny? Okay. So I'll turn this over to Penny. She gets the magic wand.
Thank you, Steve. What I'd first like to do is just walk through the results, and then what I'd like, I think it's important to come back to at least the first two topics and dive in very deeply to understand a little bit more about the comparators that we're looking at, outcomes that are important, and try to get a little bit more specificity around these topics. And finally, what I'd like to do is think more broadly about if we were to fund a study in this particular area, what kind of level of funding would be needed to fund a study in this area? Is it appropriate for us to put us into, for example, our broad funding announcement, which is around $1.5 to $5 million, or is it more appropriate to move it into our pragmatic studies funding announcement, where we really do need a lot more priority topics? So I would be, you know, very happy if we got a whole handful to add to that. And then the other question is whether or not people think it's appropriate for a targeted funding announcement. As Leah mentioned, this is something that the Scientific Oversight Committee also addresses and also the board addresses too, but I'd really be interested in your opinions on this before we present the results of that. So, oops, what happened here? What do I do? I'm sorry, I pushed the wrong button, but that's okay. I think I can still move forward. And Lauren's going to make this big for me, which is great. So there was a pretty clear winner here, and I think this also reflected some of the earlier votes for this before we came to this face-to-face meeting, where there was a lot of consensus from the panel that this was a high-priority topic. As you can see, it's scored significantly higher in terms of the overall score, and then it also, its overall rank was about one. Lauren, can you tell me, regretfully, I just got these this morning. What do you mean by a weighted calculation?
So this is actually it was the fifth question on the survey, and it asked everyone to place a rank on the topic, number one being the most important, number four being the least important. And so the survey tool that we use, which is called SurveyGizmo, does an automatic ranking based on which level you indicated for each topic. So the highest ranking or the number one ranked topic received a weighted score or a higher score than each of the following topics. So it's weighted, and then, you know, depending on how many individuals indicate that a topic should be number one, that's what produces that weighted score or ranking.
Okay. Clearly, yeah, this is Ann Sales. I just want to say I understand that. If I had known that when I did my ratings, I would have still done the same rating. But I think that what the average score is then doesn't really reflect the scores that as people put them down. Because I'll just say, I know I rated, because I had to rate something number four out of the four topics, and I put a comment in that I really struggle because I find all of these equally compelling in many ways. So I did rate discharge from NICU, I think, as the lowest, and that would have downweighted all of my scores. And all I'm saying is, therefore, I understand that that's the way SurveyGizmo does it, but I think that we also do need, for the purposes of sort of the public record, to say what the unweighted scores were, because I think they'd be quite different and much, much more clumped together than this appears to be.
And honestly, I started with this slide because it's an overall picture, but within the next four slides, you'll see the data in a detailed format that will kind of pull out, how you ranked according to each of the criteria and for each of the topics. And so it'll show a better, closer picture once we kind of get through the rest of it.
All right, so I would like to pause on this slide just for a moment to see if anybody else has any particular comments on this before we move to each of the individual topics and look at the detailed data.
Great, Mayor.
One thing I always do when I have data is check it again, and I'm wondering if it's possible that the scores got reversed here somehow, so that actually the ranking is opposite of what you've presented, both scores and ranking. And I, you know, it just sometimes happens when you're running statistics and data.
Especially since the numbers before were, it reversed you, right? So anyway, I know that I made that mistake first when I started going, okay, which one is the four and which one is the three, and then it's like, oh, no, it's the ranking, and I have to reverse it, but so I don't know if anybody else.
Yeah, I'm happy to go back and look at that question. Like I said, this is just a picture of the number five question that was on the survey. So I can take a look again. I didn't calculate it. As I said, it produces a report, and this is how the system produced it. So, but I'll take a look and just double check.
Are we not going to go through? We're going to go through each individual one anyway.
Yeah,
right?
And I think it'll help kind of looking at each of the topics individually.
Right.
So, Penny, if you want to continue, and I'll also take a look at the report.
And Mayor, you mind putting your 10 cards down as we move forward? Thanks.
Okay, so these are the results from the pharmacy question, and I guess I did look through the detailed results before when I looked at the overall slides, and they seemed consistent, so I wasn't really questioning the underlying data so much. But as you can see here, we're looking even at the criteria by criteria. A high proportion of people voted for it as either, you know, more than moderately high to high, or I guess moderately high to high, in terms of importance. And, you know, it was really across the board of the different criteria that we're looking at. There was a little bit sort of fewer people. Well, not, it's really pretty across the board for all of these criteria. So I just want to pause here again and, you know, after yesterday's discussion on this particular topic and reflections by the panel members, if you could just tell me why people felt that this was an important topic and talk a little bit about just reactions to this.
And you want to start it?
Yeah, I'm happy to. I think that this has been an untapped resource for a long time and that pharmacy is an integral member of the team that has a unique lens but a complementary lens in the context of healthcare. And I think it can reduce barriers, which is so important. There's many barriers in place in the healthcare system, and putting pharmacy in that key position, I think, will help patients overall and decrease our risk.
Thank you. Eve and then Annie.
This is Eve. I do think this is an important topic. I also think it's one that where there's already been a fair amount of research in a lot of different ways. And that may actually, that's a little bit of a double-edged sword. I mean, in some ways, research has been done, and so you think, okay, well, what's Sequoia going to contribute? But in other ways, and I'm kind of pausing here to think back to the earlier presentation about, you know, is there a systematic review already there that says there's gaps? That also, if there's going to be a systematic review, that also suggests that there's actually evidence on the topic. And some of these other things, maybe there's less evidence on. So again, that's good for PCORI, but then it's also, in some ways, are you contributing as much to the literature? One of the things I was thinking about last night about pharmacy, I mean, the pharmacist interaction with the team and with patients is so important, and I've seen that in my own personal practice. But so is the physical therapist, and so is the nurses. And so is, you know, so I'm kind of, I'm pausing here to wonder why we are focusing only on the pharmacist versus the team or essential team members, especially, you know, and the optometrist and whatever, you know, I mean, so kind of additional kind of expense. Extenders of primary care, if you will, or integral parts of primary care to allow improvements in care. So that's not, I still think the pharmacist is important. It's cleaner. For PCORI, it's easier. One of the things that I'm concerned about a little bit after this morning's presentation is that we're picking off easy topics, topics where there's already been a lot of research, instead of kind of really saying, okay, what's next on the horizon and making PCORI cutting edge. That's not a pharmacy-specific issue. That's a more general issue. But okay, that's all.
Go ahead, Annie.
This is Ann Sales. I'll be perfectly honest and say I voted for this partly because I think it was well-articulated in the brief, and I think it was well-articulated by a couple of people who happen to be pharmacists sitting on this panel, and that's really helpful. But I honestly voted for it because I think this topic could result in potentially more system change in the system of care than many of the other things we talk about and think about. Because healthcare, the sector, is human resource driven. And the big issues that we face within it right now, in my opinion, have to do with how we deploy and use those human resources. And I think that there's huge evidence that across the board, Eve kind of cataloged many of the different kinds of people, the different kinds of providers available to deliver care in an increasingly complex system in which costs are a major, major factor, and there are different costs associated with the kinds of people we're talking about. And I think by beginning here, PCORI can make a huge contribution. I'm also going to jump the gun a little and say, I actually think, especially based on your point about how much prior research has been done, that this may be one to look at for pragmatic trial as a big study, not a bunch of little studies. So that's the other reason why I thought that it was important, and I gave it, I think I gave it the number one ranking, because I think that it does have the potential, in part because of all the characteristics that people have already commented on, to actually move things forward.
Trent, can I just say something? And I don't know if this is appropriate as a staff member or not, but I can say that there is really rapid change occurring in this area, and that there's a real sort of centralization with CVS, Caremark, and Express Scripts, and that there's like they're really moving aggressively to see themselves as part of a healthcare provider, not as a a pharmacist on the corner. So it is a really kind of interesting phenomenon that's happening right now, and if it's inappropriate for me to say this as a staff, then I can be slapped after this meeting. But anyway, I just want to make that comment.
I think we have John, were you still in this? Okay, sorry. Then Jamie, David, and then Dan.
So I rank this highly because in part of the durability discussion, which I guess it actually got lower durability scores than some of the other criteria, but I think of all the things we talked about, because of some of the reasons that Ann talked about and it being a personnel issue, that it had high durability, that it is an issue that's associated with what I was talking about yesterday in terms of just tackling the challenges of multiple chronic conditions. It's not tackling the whole challenge, but it's tackling a part of it, and polypharmacy and people that are struggling to, deal with their medications for their COPD and their heart disease and their diabetes, and getting the pharmacist to be able to help the general care provider tackle some of those issues, I think would be an important step. And then it just seemed like we talk a lot, in our community about team-based care and promoting team-based care. We have multidisciplinary summits. And for some reason, we always seem to leave out the pharmacist. And it is something that, as I wonder, as we all are talking about, team-based care and better integrated care, and I'm not sure the answer to this question, but how often does the pharmacist sort of, not on purpose, but, get left out of that discussion? And maybe this is a big step that we can take to solving that.
Thank you, Jamie. David?
Thanks. I'm also intrigued when I look at some of the data on the frequency table, kind of the spread around the assessment of current options and durability of information, so kind of building on Jamie's comment there. And I think around the options piece, it's been discussed that there are several different types of interventions that have been in play that are developing rapidly now. So when I think about kind of the ripeness of an opportunity for PCORI to really jump in and take a role here in funding some pretty key research, it seems to be a pretty good time. So, when I look at the timeliness. The other thing I wanted to address is I agree with the comments you're saying, and I guess I'd like to recharacterize the concern around kind of an easy topic, because I wouldn't call this necessarily, quote, an easy topic, more that it's more, I think, a natural approach to look at the pharmacist in this particular setting around medication use. It seems to be, I think, an appropriate first step. When looking at the different healthcare providers that are critical to interacting with patients. So obviously I did both this pretty high across the board, so I do think the timing's right.
Thank you, David. Dan?
Dan Turkin, a couple of comments. I think a strong rationale for looking at pharmacy is that we don't call medicine, or we call it medicine for a good reason. Most people leave the doctor's office with a prescription, polypharmacy, all of this. This is sort of almost the default of medical practice. That makes it sound a little negative, but it's something that's very common. I think most people over age 50 are on at least one medication, something like that. So it's huge, with a lot of attendant risks, and including of antibiotic resistance. So the more that we can get expertise into these prescription decisions, the better we are off in the healthcare system. It's huge. The other thing I just want to say is that I would prefer to defer decisions or suggestions about whether or not there should be a large pragmatic trial or a smaller trial until we see what the ultimate research question and policy, you know, whatever the final brief is, whatever we call that. It's because it's a little hard to know without having that detail.
Thank you. I have Michael and then Jay.
Michael Duenia. I just want to point out, you know, I mentioned yesterday as an optometrist, I also taught in a pharmacy school at Florida A&M University. And I think what we've learned over the years is that chronic care is team care. And I think that it's important to identify all the members of the team and make sure that they're used to their fullest extent. And I think that in the health center system, they've made steps to do that. Under the umbrella of primary care, they now include behavioral mental health, dental, pharmacy, and vision care, where optometrists are considered part of that essential primary care team. I think we've those of you who are here realize that it seems like PCORI has addressed behavioral mental health quite a lot. We've taken on dental. I think it's time to take on pharmacy. I'd just like to point out that leaves a couple others out. So I hope that you understand that the next shoe to fall might be optometry or PT or one of these others that are essential to the primary care team. And as we look at primary care. And I also want to point out that from a chronic disease standpoint, we are in an epidemic situation. Diabetes is, of course, an epidemic. And I think that there's a role for pharmacy in pre-diabetes. You know, we have almost 80 million Americans with pre-diabetes. Many of these Americans, if caught early, could escape the ravages of diabetes, overt diabetes. And I don't think we've looked at how to use pharmacy well to identify these individuals with prediabetes and get them into DPP treatments and other things. You know, I think that there are good research questions for this, but I just wanted to let you know about that other shoe that's about to fall. Thank you.
Thanks, Jake. Oops, excuse me.
So this is Jake. Again, I'm a pharmacist for those on the phone call. And I just wanted to say thank you to everybody for supporting pharmacy right now. It's very exciting. So on behalf of my profession, thanks. But I think this is very timely. For those that haven't checked your email, I just sent out something that came from the National Governors Association, and it talks about the role of pharmacists in healthcare. And it shows that we do have good evidence. It does show that we have outcome data, but it's all sporadic little cells, and it's not a whole health system approach, and I think that is what PCORI is, especially our panel, improving healthcare systems. And so we can use the might of PCORI, sounds like an action hero right now, but the might of PCORI to change healthcare, and this is something that's very perfect in that timing. And then to go with everybody else said, you start with pharmacy, and then let's just go down the road to everybody else that hasn't been part of that team.
Any other comments on this one before we move to the next topic item? Great. Jenny?
All right. So this second topic is looking at suicide prevention. And as I recall, yesterday people were very interested in potentially focusing this topic on a targeted population of teenagers, although that's still open to question. The basic points here is that this scored pretty well with some questions about whether or not it was the findings from research in this area would be implementable or would be taken out by the healthcare system. So maybe we can have a little bit of discussion about that specific concern.
Susan?
Yeah, I think I would say that probably gets to thinking about questions, and I think that rather than spend that time now, we maybe should move forward, because I think that gets into the details of what it is we're talking about. So.
This is Susan Salisher. I agree with Anne, but I want to point out specifically, this is very high and patient-centered, which is what we should be about. So I agree that we can wait and look at the question, but I think do not want to lose sight that this is highly, highly important based on this slide.
Okay, thank you. Michael?
Just looking at these scores, I've got some concern in that a large percentage of us chose many of these as moderate. In the conversations yesterday, I got the impression that everyone thought this was very important and very patient-centered. However, I think that suicide prevention is not just a health systems issue, and that there's other systems involved that are integrally involved in this. That make it a little bit more difficult for us to approach it, I think, or if we do approach it, it's going to take something outside of just the healthcare system. So I don't know. I see that only three, and is this correct, that only three people chose it as their number one? Is that what this is showing?
If we go back to the first slide.
Thank you.
I'm not sure this slide even gives us that information. No.
Laura, if you stay on the slide that you were on, just so we can clarify the last column, go back to the previous slide.
Sure. Sorry, for some reason it's not. Oh, there we go.
There we go. So,
oh, sorry. It's jumping all
over
the place.
So
okay.
I think Michael's just asking for clarification for the last column on the right, that overall, if you could just speak to what that represents. Because he's saying, I think you're accurate. I think that tallies up to 17, and so we said there were 17 responses, and so these how those 17 responses play out. Is that incorrect?
So the last column was actually part of the question. So you had the five criteria that you were rating the question on, and then also an overall score. So your overall impression of how well this topic or question fit for PCORI across all five of those criteria. So it was its own question, and there was one response for everyone. So if you felt overall it ranked a four, there were eight of you that indicated that.
Right, so maybe just to be clear, so the delineation we're making is this is the one question within the individual, as we were going through within the individual topic, then we have that previous slide that has the overall, after you complete the whole survey, then people rank. Is that the demand?
That's correct.
Great. Yep. Okay. Thanks. Michael, did that answer?
Yes. Could you go to the next slide or the previous slide? I'm just curious. I just wanted to see. Right. And then go to the next one. Oh, I'm sorry. And then the next one, it should have less than in the number five, right? But that has six. Okay, I just don't know.
The number of people voting, it's not
right. Right.
Ranking.
Right, the question is, so let me, Alan, quick response on this, and then we'll go to Doris.
Yeah, I think it's more important to look at the weighting that's coming from people who scored things 4 and 5. So if you look at pharmacy, there's a total of 14 out of 17 who had considered to be relatively high. If you look at suicide prevention, there are 11. And if you go to the next slide, which is decision support, there's only 8. And you can see there are 6 that thought it was more moderate, not in the high category. And go to the last one. You see discharge from the NICU, there are only 7 who rated it 4 or 5. And I think that's what reflects the weighting.
I believe that was where Michael was headed originally. Doris and then John.
So I believe Penny is asking the people that rated this a 2 for implementation to reveal themselves. But absent that, I was not one of those 2. But recall that our healthcare systems diagram of the concentric circles goes into the community and beyond, into a state policy perspective, even a national perspective and such. And so when I think about healthcare systems, I don't just think about those people who provide direct kind of medical healthcare services, medical services. I think about the whole thing. And while, again, I was not one of the 2, my guess would be, building off of Michael's comments, that the thought of what is our, as I look around the table, we're all more in that medical model, what is our sphere of influence to get adoption by folks in the community, state, national perspective? And that may be where the lower ranking comes from. Not a huge deterrent. Again, it was only 2 out of the 17 people that scored. But, if the 2 of you are comfortable, either corroborate that or please enhance the discussion by telling us a little bit about why you thought it was tough to implement.
I just want to say it's not just the 2, that there's kind of moderate as well. So I'm not actually asking people to reveal themselves here, but it just raises an issue. So I just.
Right. In comparison to the previous one, the implementation column is lower. Is that what you're highlighting, right? Is that okay? So while it was higher on patient centeredness, it was much lower when it came to impact and implementation in comparison to the pharmacy intervention. And so I think that's what you're right. John, and then
part of what I was going to say was what Doris said. So I would just want to reemphasize the fact that how we consider the healthcare system is very important here. And going back just to the discussion we just had on pharmacy, for pharmacists, we said, what's the next shoe to drop? I'm sure social workers would argue with you, this is very important for them and part of the system as well. And so as we're moving into the patient-centered medical homes and these new models of care, we really have to be cognizant of the fact that this is part of the healthcare system, for sure. So we don't want to lose that.
Thank you, John. Ann?
Yes, this is Ann Sales. I completely agree with both of the last comments, and I'm pretty sure I weighted this one pretty low on implementation, and the reason for that is because it is, first of all, it's very low incidence compared to so many other things that we've looked at. And so when you think about how this moves into patients in medical homes or direct delivery system stuff, it's really hard because as a provider, you may never have to deal with this issue in your entire career. And some providers deal with it a lot, depending on their populations, depending on other things. So targeting is really important. But I just want to, and this is, again, jumping ahead, but not to the what mechanism issue, but instead to the where are we going with this whole discussion about our re-ratings and these slides. If we're trying to differentiate among the 4 topics that we have and say 2 of them rise to a higher level across whatever criteria seem to be making them rise there, I'm just going to comment that if we end up with the pharmacist integration issue topic and suicide prevention topic, we will have one that's relatively easy and straightforward in some ways, as you pointed out, and we will have one that is really hard. And I think that may not be a bad thing. So I just wanted to say that because I think we need to be thinking about, in addition to the topic-by-topic conversation, kind of where are we going with this?
I'd just like to give you my perspective on that. When I'm looking at these votes, and particularly when I was looking at the pre-votes, I did feel like there was not clear lines of discrimination across these, and we are very interested in finding high-priority topics. And so, unless people just really feel that this is not a topic of high priority,
I would like to find a way for us to potentially include these. In fact, at some point in time, I would like to revisit some of the ones that didn't make this list and where they're going to come back. And then also I'd like to revisit some of the ones that were originally sent to our contractor and that we felt that the quality of the briefs weren't good enough to pass on. So those are still out there percolating. I just don't want to lose sight of the collection. But I do feel like focusing on the first, the highest ranked ones and trying to really get specifics is going to be where we're going to spend some of our day. So, yeah.
Just to, before I go to Eve and then to Dan, just to clarify, because at 10:15 we'll transition to the question component. And so I want to make certain after we go through these, right, after we go through these other two, is it your anticipation that there's further discussion, or do we continue with the ones that we based upon the overnight results, the top two? How are you envisioning the 10:15 session?
So, let's see, the 10:15 session, what's the
question refinement? I was
wrong. That one is where we're going to go into the actual top two. And,
right.
Yeah.
And so it is. So we'll get. So we'll. I'm assuming that you tell me if this is wrong procedure. Is what I'm verifying as we continue to move through the last two. Nothing has changed. We're not getting ready to vote again today. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just very interested in understanding.
Right. That's what I was
just.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. Great.
And Doris Lost. I just wanted to follow up on your comment about you think this is you're saying this is you know sort of a lower incidence, and I'm not pushing back on the idea. I just want to go back to some of the numbers that were presented in the issue brief. So we've got 8 million adults with serious thoughts of suicide, 2.5 million adults making a plan, 1.1 million adults with an attempt. Your characterization is still that the aggregate of those known.
No, I'm only talking about completed suicide.
Completed suicide. Okay.
I'm talking about the tip of the iceberg piece, and you're absolutely right about the rest of the continuum. Yes.
I mean, it doesn't break 10 million, so you know, on a 330 million population country, it's still a small percentage. But you were specifically thinking about. Okay. Thank you.
Eve and then Dan.
So I just wanted to say that one way to think about these ratings, and particularly the things like implementation or maybe even durability, is to think about it strategically during the funding and stakeholder development process. So if what we're thinking is that, gosh, this is going to be really hard because if we're focusing on teens, we've got to get the schools involved, and we've got to get the state pediatric society involved, and we've got to get, you know, that says to me that those are the stakeholders that have to be around the table for a successful project. So because then we're looking at downstream dissemination, and we have to rely on those stakeholders to help disseminate those findings to their kind of colleagues, if you will, in other states or in other communities. So I would look at that if we're saying this is really important, we have to do this, but we have to do it right, and we have to do it in a way we have to pay attention to implementation because that's one of the really hard things. Let's look at that rating as a way to improve the call, the RFA, the PFA, whatever, to make sure the right people are around the table so that we can overcome that barrier.
Right, Dan.
Dan Turpin, this is sort of a variation on what you just said. It's actually quite different in some ways. I view that distribution on implementation as a flag of concern that many of us have about whether or not this is going to be implementable, whatever it is. And I think it would be one approach would be to focus the next efforts on exploring that in more depth with the appropriate stakeholders who could tell you there's no way this will ever be implemented, or yeah, just get us this information and we'll go with it. So I'd rather spend a little more time scoping out what the issues are underlying these concerns and to determine if they're really valid or not, because there is a split. But, you know, eight people, that's about half, said, careful here, I think. Given the skewed positive distributions of all of this, this kind of stands out.
Great. And also just maybe a quick comment. Dan just jogged my memory of yesterday when I was asking about USPSTF and your process. Does something like this go in front of that? Does someone just systematically view and you know, come to some resolution about the delineation between where they landed when they did their systematic review versus where you moved forward? So, again, that might fall into some of your process in terms of implementation if you move forward.
Go ahead.
You don't have to answer. I'm just making a comment for the record. Let's go to the next one, if it's okay. That was from before. Okay, go ahead, Michael. Sorry, I thought that was from before. Yours from before now. Okay.
Michael Duane, I just wanted to follow up with what Eve and Ann said. I think this is a very important issue. I think that what Doris mentioned, the fact that if you look at all the iterations of suicidal tendencies, many of those iterations follow through to other illnesses that that actually may or may not involve issues outside of the healthcare system. So what I'm trying to mention is that if we're going to do this, I'd like to make sure that we do it right, we do it comprehensively, and that we understand that there's various systems in play. And one system that has been left out of this is the justice system, and there's many issues with the justice system that intersect this. Many of the unknown reasons why teens kill themselves are not based on anything that has to do with whether we have a good healthcare system or not. And I think that if we overlook that and overlook many of these things, that we're not going to get to the type of sensitivity that we need in addressing this most important issue. I gave it a low implementation score because if we do come out with that kind of approach that's needed, it's going to be hard to implement because you're going to have to go across systems to implement this. So it's a challenge. I like what Ann said. Let's pick something easy and let's pick something hard. But if we pick something hard, let's do it right. Thank you.
All right, Penny, we're ready to move to the third. Great.
All right. So this one, I think there was quite a bit of active discussion about this and differences of opinion on this particular one. This is clinical decision support, and specifically the brief targeted the chronic disease, multiple chronic disease population. Here we have pretty consistent concerns about both the likelihood of positive results being implemented as well as the durability. So I think that might warrant a little bit more discussion, and if people want to just say some general comments, too, about why they voted the way they did.
Great. Thank you. Jay?
Thanks. So I guess when I look at this one, I honestly am biased and I compare it against the integration of the pharmacist. And when we talk about pharmacist-driven medication management, oftentimes that helps out with chronic diseases. And so for me, the system approach would be, well, integrate another member of the healthcare team, and it inadvertently will help something along these lines. So maybe the decision support isn't an EMR technology, but somebody else in the team. And so that's why I probably voted this one lower than I did the pharmacist, because I'd rather see that. The implementation of the pharmacist is already structured there. So.
Thank you. Dan Turpin. I had a chat with Alan about this yesterday, and we came to it with very different thoughts about the implementation issues. Alan was concerned about the varying electronic medical record systems out there, and which one would you go with, and some of these other issues. I'll let Alan comment on that because I'm not sure I'm getting it right. And my whole notion of this field is based on research I'm doing, funded by PCORI, on back pain, where implementing in the electronic health record a tool that the physicians can use to better tailor treatment to the needs of patients is central and has gone really, it's easy to do. It's, we found it technically easy to implement in Epic. It's not a big deal. So I think this decision support is kind of vague, and I think it was Anne, maybe somebody was saying we should think of this as an electronic health record as being, or maybe Eve, a key part of this, and that makes sense. Certainly, the electronic health record provides a new tool which is increasingly being used to help ensure or to minimize risks of the inappropriate and harmful things happening. So it's a technology that is there, it's being used, but its potential hasn't been fully developed. And so I think depending on what each of us brings in our own minds from our own experiences to this question, the idea of implementation may seem either totally horrific or no problem. And so I think that's a little bit of a challenge here that it would be good to work out before we make a decision, you know, one way or the other.
Okay. Let me go to John and Alan and then myself.
Yeah, just to follow up on what Dan said, I think, although I agree it could be easy, I think getting access to some of the systems is not easy for implementing certain applications or other decision support tools that could be used just based on experience we've had. And so I would say that, you know, implementing this, while it could be an easy thing to do, it's not always as easy as it sounds, so there's a challenge there. I do think this could have a tremendous impact on the healthcare system. So certainly I was in support of that, as in support of this actual topic as well. So.
Thank you, Alan.
To build on what Dan was saying, I looked at the patient-centered scores for all four here. And if you notice, it's almost an even split, 4 and 5 categories, a total of 9 people versus 8 for 3 and below. When you compare that with the other 3 topics, all of which in different forms had at least 14 people saying they were highly patient-centered. So from my perspective, this was the least patient-centered of the 4 topics we considered. My principal concern had to do with the durability of the information, and I see it was shared by a number of folks, at least 11, 10 others. But I also was persuaded somewhat by what each said yesterday about doing this the right way. And I think there is still merit here. I don't think this is something that should go forward now. I think we need to reframe the question. My real concern was the breadth with which the question is now framed. And I agree with Dan that if we could find a way in the next session to reframe it so that it would have more targeted research objectives, then it might very well be something that should rise to the top in the next session of the panel.
Great. And then we'll go to Jamie.
But I also think the breadth of how it's framed may in the meantime lend itself to being included in the broader, you know, large pragmatic trials, so I think it would require more. While we should revisit in the next session and try to narrow it down if it's going to be carried forward for a possible targeted announcement, I don't think that we should lose that time because I think there is a lot of potential, and it is a timely issue that it should be one that gets put into the list of priorities in the large pragmatic trials.
Yeah, let me just...
I hope you didn't misinterpret what I was saying. I wasn't saying it should be in a targeted solicitation. I'm not even talking about where it should be. I'm just saying is the research question as it now is stated is, in my opinion, much too broad for useful research, and it really needs to be focused. Maybe I shouldn't have used the word targeted, but more focused so that we can get a good set of studies out of it.
All right, let me see how many we have, and then we're going to go to the last one to stay on schedule. So if you have a pressing comment on this one, let's go ahead and run through them. Was it Michael or Dan next? Dan.
We don't have time now to really get into a thorough discussion of this whole concept of patient-centeredness, but I think it's an issue that this group would do well to kind of example, even if it's well articulated, is not viewed as patient-centered, then that's a signal that this group needs to really have, that there's a whole host of kinds of system interventions that are not as obviously patient-centered and that we should not consider them, or alternatively, they are patient-centered but in a different way than some of the other things are. So I would like to have that as a future topic.
Thank you. Michael?
I just want to point out that the whole point of our discussion yesterday, I thought, was that, in fact, the way clinical decision support is being done now is not patient-centered. And that's the whole point. The point is that it's not patient-centered and it needs to be patient-centered. So I agree with everything that was said. I think the question needs to be reframed now that we have a better understanding of what the gaps are. And I would hope that the question gets reframed and it gets put back in the hopper because, again, this is on the curve that we need to be on. And it's the systems changes that we can make, and I think PCORI is in the best position to add value to this conversation. Thank you.
Go ahead, Annie and Danann.
Yeah, I definitely scored this low for patient-centeredness. A couple of points to make is, one, we did have a brief discussion yesterday about patients having access to their medical record. And around decision-making, I really think that that's the PCORI, is when a patient, and I've looked online a little bit, and there are a number of institutions that have allowed patients to have access to their medical records are in informing decisions. I think that's what we'd be interested in looking at, because right now it's just not patient-centered enough.
Yeah, this is Ann Sales. I just want to make kind of a procedural comment. Right now, PCORI has out on the street and requests for applications for the next round of PCORNET. In some ways, Trent actually made this suggestion yesterday, and I went and looked at Open Notes, and I know that Trent and Alan talked about it. And I think there was some buzz around, you know, is there an opportunity for a group like Open Notes, which is fostering and promoting patient access to their own record, and by doing that, participating in decision support that could be where the electronic health record could actually mediate shared decision making or at least constant discussion between provider and patient. I think that bringing this back is a fine idea, but I just also want to say one of the things we've never talked about because the whole PCORNET thing is new and has kind of evolved again on a sort of parallel path, is there a role for advisory panels like ours to make suggestions for the RFAs that go out for PCORNET and to help with targeting those. That's a slightly different thing from pragmatic clinical trials or something else. And I just wanted to ask that.
This will be the last comment on this one, Lisa.
Yeah, so I just wanted to clarify yesterday that part of my difficulty with what we were doing was that I came in with all of these questions feeling a little bit disturbed by the process. So even the questions that we were given just smacked of catering more towards researchers than towards what patients were asking for. And I think part of that was just a lack of clear communication from PCORI. Because over the last 24 hours of being able to talk to people, I'm reassured, like I often am when I actually talk to people at PCORI, that they're making good decisions in hiring, that they are including patients, that they are doing that, but they're not leading with it. It's like when it was presented, it was like they were hiding their patient-centeredness. Like, you know, when we talked about the work groups that convened, you know, in January, when you're talking about patient-centered outcomes to groups that are interested in that, it's important to lead, just like you would have your validity and your reliability and your Delphi and all that. It's important to say, these were the patients that were involved, and this was the amount of patients that were involved, and this is the ways that they were involved in it. And that has been missing from the work leading up to this in this conversation. So it's like elevating that as a requirement in the presentation is just as important as weighted scales and things of that sort when we're in this arena, because it starts to look like that this is the researcher-centered outcomes research institute. And that's really my concern. Outside of here, I would be much more reasonable about some of this stuff. But my capacity in here is to assure that patient-centeredness is the priority. And in talking about that, then we have to talk about power differentials, even in parents, you know, and family members and patients advising this. We have to look at political climates. We have to look at all of that. And so my goal in this capacity is not to gum up the process, but to make sure that red flags are going and that people outside of this arena are starting to go, wait a minute, you know, am I using my privileged Caucasian PhD bias on this, or am I thinking about the, you know, am I thinking about the Hispanic non-English speaking single mother in rural, you know, Texas, that, you know, when I'm approaching these kinds of things, just to kind of broaden all of that. So I think it would be nice to talk about patient-centeredness and to look for even in something that you have to reflect in research and all of it, to look at where is my bias and my experience coloring this process. And even though there are patient advocates and caregivers on this, we are still a privileged section. We still have master's degrees or PAs, and we still have the capability to front a couple $100 to travel to D.C. every quarter, you know, all that stuff. So we're still not even indicative of the ground-level users of healthcare a lot of this time. So that's I think it's nice to talk about doing that, but that's really where I was coming from yesterday, was I was just kind of disturbed by not their communication. I'm assured now that PCORI is making good choices. They're doing things. I want to go on the record saying that. But I would encourage them to be a little bit more upfront and, like, rock your patient-centeredness out instead of, like, it just seemed like it was, like, the dirty secret. Like, we have to hide that we do that so that we can be legitimate in some area or something. And having to pull that out also just kind of cheapens it. It's like, you know, like we should be teaching other people that if they're going to show up and talk about patient-centeredness, then there needs to be a slide. Just like there was with the methods and the limitations and all of that, there should be a slide that shows this is how we effectively engage the people that this legislation and the spirit of it were intended to serve us. So that's it. Thanks.
Let's go to the next slide.
All right. So here we are on NICU, and I actually was a little bit surprised at these results because I felt like yesterday there seemed to be a lot of enthusiasm for this topic, but it got ranked a little bit lower after the discussion of yesterday. Many more people weighing in on kind of moderate across the board for the different criteria that we're looking at as well as the overall score. So I just want to clarify, is this something that we should sort of set aside, or is this something that people feel could be done if we did this, reframed this a little bit differently? I know we are studying a fairly large study in this. I mean, we are funding a fairly large study in this area. This is going to be an important one, but it's one study. So anyway, I just wanted to get perspective. Again, back to Lisa's point, this did score very high on patient-centeredness.
Annie?
Yeah, so my take on this one was, one, there's a fair amount being done. Two, as Penny said, there is the Lodge Navigator study that's happening. Three, in my experience with NICU families, they have a voice. That, I think, the patient sentiment came out there, because you cannot take care of their baby without integrating the family dynamics into it. And so given the breadth of what we had to look at, I just felt a lot's being done. Some of the technology stuff that I mentioned could be done, doesn't need a PCORI. So while I think the topic is a fantastic one, I just don't think it's where we should be putting our efforts. I think there's a lot being done there.
Anne?
Yeah, two things from our conversation yesterday actually swayed me quite a bit. One was Lisa's point about medically fragile children overall. And you know, children leaving neonatal ICU are medically fragile, many of them. And so that they would fit into that category. But that somehow speaks much more to me than just infants out of the NICU. And the other was this is where I started thinking, you know, and the brief made the point. It's kind of a bimodal distribution. On the one hand, you have often very young, but mothers who are disproportionately from race ethnic minority groups, disproportionately low education, low income, a bunch of social determinants of health stuff clustering around their needs and outcomes. And then the other mode is women over 40, most of whom, not exclusively, are upper income and middle class. And so it's not that they don't have needs. Of course they do. But in all likelihood, their needs are probably better met. I really started thinking about this as one that, and this is not something we haven't really talked through, but kind of came up in the context of the IPV conversation. I think the Addressing Disparities panel may also have ideas, thoughts, and want to weigh in on this topic, or even the expanded topic of medically fragile children. So I know that's not very coherent, but that's kind of, for me, that weighted my scores on this.
Thank you. Mary?
This is the one that really kind of shocked me, and the reason I even suggested perhaps we need the report had been reversed, because the general tenor of the discussion yesterday I thought was uniformly positive. In my mind, it has an impact beyond the medically fragile children or babies, because it's families, the whole thing. I think the impact is great. The assessment of options, I mean, the fact that there has been quite a bit done, to me, sets this topic in good standing for a comparative effectiveness type of approach. And so I thought that was very strong. I think it would be implemented widely. The information provided is not going to wear out, within the next couple of years like the decision support system would. It would be durable. And anyway, just wanted to say I hope we don't drop this, because I do think it's extremely important.
Jane?
Just a question. Do you consider taking on topics jointly with a panel like Disparities? And I think, we talked about a couple that would lend themselves to that.
Well, we have, for example, we have a joint effort around perinatal care, because both of the advisory panels in each group said this was a high priority topic. So we have precedent for that.
So you're talking about the perinatal care, and when we really look at this group of NICU babies, prematurity is the number one. So if we go further back in time and really look at moms and the disparity that leads to prematurity, I think then there's the opportunity to really make an impact, because that is an area that begs for research.
Great. We're up against moving to the next item. So, Penny, I think you're leading that as well with the handouts, or are we just slides for that?
There are handouts, and I just wanted to also comfort Mary by just letting her know that if we did reverse the scores, it probably wouldn't have made a lot of difference here. So. Everybody's kind of clustered in the middle. But Lauren does have handouts, and what I'd like to do is move to the two top-ranked topics and dig in a little bit deeper about potential research questions now.
We've been kibitzing at the top of the table here about whether there's a break. There's not one formally scheduled, and since we see people kind of floating off when they need to, we're going to continue with that pattern. So there's not going to be a formal break. We're going to go straight on through 11:30. If you need to do something, please feel free to go ahead and do that, and then join the conversation again when you return.
All right. Regretfully, we don't have whiteboards or we don't have anything to write on, which I think is always a lot easier for thinking about topic refinement and trying to get into the wording of these. I think what I'd like to do, let's see, how much time do we have? We have an hour and 10 minutes. What I'd like to do is spend maybe about 20 minutes per topic and then turn to kind of a broader discussion about some of the topics that we haven't talked about, as well as some of the ones that hadn't made it to this panel. So let's start with pharmacy services. From my perspective, one of the most important things is really to understand the models. And what are we talking about in terms of the different models that we want to compare? You had mentioned medication therapy management. We talked about co-location or team-based care. And I was just wondering if maybe Jake or David could just explore that question a little bit more.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Penny. I think one of the, I guess, the concerns when you look at the first question was just the phrasing on the lead piece. Maybe changing the coordinated may change the focus, that it does focus on that team-based approach, because that's really where healthcare reform is going. So I think we could make that change. I think that would be a bit more palatable.
So based on the thing that I sent out this morning, and Penny also shared a document, like 34 pages or something, that was very similar to the National Governors Association, which, by the way, that's the fourth in the series. They have three others, one on nurse practitioners, one on PAs, and one on dental hygienists. So that might be good for everybody just to look at in general. But when talking about different models, one of the things that kind of floats to mind is medication management, so a model comparing the different effects of medication management for the pharmacist. One model would be medication reconciliation. So anytime there's some type of care transition, be it into the health system, out of the health system, into a nursing home, out of a nursing home, having a pharmacist integrated with the medication reconciliation. Preventative care services. And so a really good effectiveness research model is that we have 50 states. We have pharmacists that can provide immunizations in all of those different states, but what immunizations a pharmacist can provide is different between the states. And so I'm in Georgia. If I was near Alabama, it could be a five-minute drive into Alabama, and the pharmacist could give me any immunization I want, but then I can come back to Georgia and not be able to get those same immunizations. Also, screenings. So when we talk about access, and Lisa was pointing this out yesterday, just access to health care, you have the community pharmacist. What type of screenings can be done in that type of setting versus in health system settings? There was a pilot study about HIV screenings in pharmacies that was published a couple months ago. And so just looking at different models like that where patients can get access to care. Then you have the education counseling. That could be more of that MTM model. And, again, that's different between states on what is allowed or what isn't allowed. And then, again, the collaborative care model. And so that kind of goes back into that idea of, you know, where is the pharmacist providing care? What are they authorized to do?
This is Doris Loss. I believe, again, that's a long list. Probably can't all be embraced, but have at it. I believe that Medicare pays for MTM by pharmacists, so that would be interesting to reach out to CMS. And similarly, medical reconciliation upon discharge from a hospital is something that Medicare pays for. So if we want to look, I'm sorry, required. Susan says required. So if we want to look at where there may be some already practice in this area and look to partnering with CMS, perhaps jumping off from their data or whatever they've done to evaluate this would be a way of skinning down that list a little bit because it's not likely that it can all be embraced. So I believe, Susan, you were next.
So I do want to caution us. I mean, Mike brought this point up and Jacob brought this point up, and I'm a PA, and there are many states that we are limited in our practice. It's not about the provider. You know, we've got to keep this patient-centered. And so that was my concern with saying pharmacy-led. It's not about the provider. So that needs to be at the forefront. And I say that as a PA who probably has the least expanded practice of anyone at this table. So I think we need to be careful of that. I'm not here representing PAs. I'm here representing patients. And so I want to make sure the intervention we look at is the impact on the patient. So that's why I kind of moved away from that first question to the second one, because I thought if we looked at different interventions, ones that are working, ones that aren't working so well, maybe it's working in this state and not in that state. So I just want to make sure that we keep the focus on intervention that helps patients to have the right medications, to be educated about why they how they should take their warfarin, you know, their diabetic medication. So just be careful when we start talking about scope of practice. I think you need to be very cautious here, because this is not about our profession. It's about our profession making patient care better.
Lisa?
Yeah, I just wanted to reiterate that, is that the reason that I was interested in this and just having the experience of having a medically fragile child that was on, like, 8 epilepsy medications at one time and having to manage that through clinic-based, you know, community-based pharmacies, and the linkage with primary care was really difficult. And then, like, in particular, there was one point where, you know, like, Keppra. We couldn't get her to keep taking Keppra because she just refused to take it, and so she actually started refusing any milk or food or anything. And so what ultimately wound up happening was we had to do a three-way call with our primary and the pharmacist, and the pharmacist was like, what's the big deal? You know, he'd never heard of it. He tasted it, and then he started dry heaving, and he was like, yeah, this is horrible, and then was able to make a compound suspension of a flavor that she would take. So that's like a really real-world thing that had to be negotiated between the, you know, the neurologist, the primary care, and the pharmacist to even get the kid to take the medication. Those are the kind of, like, loops that I'd be interested in, or like when we got ACTH, it's a gel, and the doctor prescribed a needle that was large enough to pull the gel out of the bottle, but too big to inject, or too small to inject into the kiddo, and so we went home with the wrong tools for it, and so they had to negotiate that, get the script, and get the materials. So when I prioritize that, that's more what I'm interested in, is I think that there's a lot of medical errors that can be attributed to a linkage between pharmacy, primary care specialty, and then what actually goes home with the patient and how they access that. So if anything, it's even increasing accessibility of the patient to the pharmacist in outside of the little window at Walgreens is kind of what I'm interested in this.
Ann?
Yeah, this is Ann Sales. I guess what I'm hearing and what I think as I'm looking at the way the questions are currently framed, they all talk about the intervention, but there's really no discussion of outcomes. And I think the outcomes are absolutely essential in terms of what we're talking about. Because if the outcomes that people kind of have in their minds are cost, rehospitalization, things like that, then I agree that that's not going to be patient-centered. I actually want to push back just a little bit, Susan, on your comment about the term pharmacist-led. I think the problem is it's not contextualized sufficiently. But that implies team, because it's leading within the care team. And I think that as I read that one in particular, which I do find compelling, although I would like to know some more about what outcomes can be measured, what's feasible, and what should go into anything that goes into an announcement. But I think if you say within the context of care teams, because the point is teams should have different leadership for different kinds of issues. And that's exactly where expertise and people's knowledge about specific things like medications, in this case, come into play. And I think Lisa's examples are really on point about why it is that pharmacists meeting on those particular elements of the care process would be important. But I think the issue, in many ways, a global issue, and this may be true for some of the other topics as well, is that the patient-centeredness has got to come through in the outcomes, and I'm not sure the outcomes are well described or discussed yet. So maybe we should spend some time there.
David?
Yeah, thanks for that. Before we jump there, I wanted to provide some additional context, and as I'm hearing this conversation, it reminds me of the conversation we had last week around ACOs, and if I can just spend 2 minutes describing the kind of evolution there, because I think we're kind of going down a similar path where the work group I was tasked with working with was around patient activation, patient and provider activation within an ACO. And we first had a framework around, you've got kind of the structural issues around the different types of ACOs, you know, whether it's community-based or hospital-based or ownership. And then, so that's more, kind of more of a structural culture, leadership focus. And then you've got the actual intervention about, you know, what are the approaches to improve patient activation. So we seem to be going down a similar type of approach here. Do we want to focus more on that kind of higher level approach, or do we want to dig deeper into the interventions and getting the feeling that that seems to be where the biggest impact is on the latter? So I wanted to share that because I think this is the natural progression we take in being this panel when dealing with health systems, is that we have to kind of go through that mental exercise and that process before we can actually start crafting up some questions for funding announcements. Just it's quite striking. Again, this is, you know, just last week we're having an ACO discussion and it kind of evolving in a similar approach here. So I want to add that additional
I guess if we're thinking about, you know, topic refinement, there are several different levels that we need to be thinking about. We need to be thinking about, you know, what are the approaches that we're going to be comparing. We need to be thinking about what populations we're going to be targeting, which is like medically fragile children is one example of that. A lot of people talked about the chronic, complex, multiple disease patients. We want to be understanding the outcomes. So, you know, all three of those dimensions, as well as the settings of care, you know, those kind of different levels are all things that we want to get through in topic prioritization, in topic refinement. And I guess we could spend more time on one versus the other, and I do think it would be really worthwhile to talk a little bit more about the outcomes and make sure that it's patient-centered, too.
I had one more comment. Yes, David, thanks for that, Penny. And again, I think the challenge we face this panel is that a lot of the outcomes are somewhat intermediary to the health system. So, for example, if we're trying to improve medication adherence or whatever with a pharmaceutical a program, or even in the ACO work group where we had improving patient activation, that really the outcome, you know, it's ultimately what's that patient-centered outcome. And I think that's also a key piece here that we're kind of struggling with a little bit with that right now. Because I do think there's an impact with involving that pharmacist in that close discussion with patients to reduce hospitalizations, to improve quality of life. For prevention, I think, is a key piece that we've discussed here today, you know, patients with chronic comorbidities. So I think there are tangible, patient populations out there that can really benefit from that better integration with the pharmacist. So.
Mary? I probably should have brought this up yesterday, but for the last couple of years, I've been serving on a technical expert panel with the Association of Health Systems Pharmacists. And what we're developing is a tool to be used in hospitals initially, although the discussion is to go on beyond that in the community, to develop an outcomes measure, basically. What patient outcomes, and despite the discussion, we'd love to have positive outcomes. Right now, it's leaning toward the avoidance of negative outcomes. But, and that's typical of most disciplines as we try to measure our outcomes. But anyway, that is about a year away from perhaps finishing and then will become available. And I think it would be something that could be blended in as an outcome measure, but it's not ready yet. So, FYI.
Jenny?
I think it's fun thinking about the outcomes for this one. Engagement. Patient feels informed, near misses, we capture near misses, medical errors, satisfaction. I don't know. And all that would be coming from the patient. So, frankly, I think measuring the outcomes on this one is would be a fun one. Be focused right.
Penny, there's no one else queued up to speak, so did you get what you needed? Do you want to rephrase a question and ask it again?
Well, I would no, there's a couple aspects of this question that I think are worthwhile pursuing. Getting back to the populations, I think, you know, we did talk about the multiple chronic comorbid population, but and medically fragile children, I can think of a whole lot of other vulnerable populations in terms of medication errors and some of the issues, and I'm just wondering if people could comment a little bit about that.
Ben?
Oh, fine. Joan? I read it, and I think that
problem is you're using the word patient care. And I think you need to use patient-centered care at least. You know, it's like listening to the entire discussion, and all of this is pre-patient-centered news is what you're talking about. It's like putting together a system and then talking about whether it will be patient-centered in the outcome, whereas so that's why it's not there at all. And it just has no relationship to patient-centeredness, the questions you have here. I mean, it could be patient-centered, it could not. It doesn't indicate that at all.
Kim?
I guess as I stop to think about kind of the next steps and the whole process of developing a funding announcement, it seems to me that, in my head at least, we're talking about potentially a funding announcement that could span many populations, not just one or two. And so maybe just listing all the potential populations for whom benefit could be seen, listing the outcomes and making sure that those outcomes really are patient-centered outcomes. And we've talked about a couple of them already. This isn't my area, so by the fact that as a patient I actually do take meds, it's not an area I find complex in my life at this point. So, again, I have a hard time commenting, but Susan has commented, I think, very eloquently about the fact that there are populations, particularly among older adults and probably among highly complex care children, people of any age, but particularly the two ends of the population extreme that are most relevant. So it seems to me that thinking about what the outcomes that are relevant and then thinking about the measurement strategies, some of these would be, I mean, things like rehospitalizations are relatively easy to measure, but some of these other things around quality of life, and does taking my meds as prescribed actually make a difference in my health, are really complex issues that we don't have good strategies for.
Ann?
Agree with what Ann was just saying. Maybe think about it, so you could capture all populations of either vulnerable, I kind of cringe when I say that word, but you get the gist of what I mean, or high users. Because certainly there's healthy people that have comorbidities that take medications and are high users. But I do think, Joan, that the outcomes, as you point out to us, have to be patient-centered. And I do think quality of life, but the engagement and satisfaction that the patient has, how much more empowered they feel to manage their medications with the added contributions of the pharmacist is what I think we should capture.
So, Dora Fox, I just wanted to comment again, narrowing down the populations. I would love to do everything, everywhere, but I think that in certain settings, the added value of the utility of having the pharmacist be a part of the team has been reasonably well established. Again, I'm thinking inside the acute care setting, potentially inside the nursing home, but I wouldn't push that too far. My request would be, though, to tap what I think is the essentially untapped area, which is out in the community. So to focus on where there's opportunity, we talked already about underutilized resources. To me, that seems to be the largest place where we're just walking to a counter, getting the pills, and checking the box that you don't want to talk to the pharmacist and walking away. The other thing I would add is, again, when we think about populations, probably not a whole bang for the buck with the little populations, the occasional users. But where there is complexity, I'm going to repeat, Medicare is in this space already with MTM. Certainly the elderly have a lot of complexity. I wouldn't necessarily want to limit it to that. We've talked about fragile children. We've talked about some other people who are high utilizers. I think that would be another way to meaningfully narrow the population so that we can get a more targeted research question. And the next person I have on my list after me is Leah.
Thanks. To reiterate and to agree with the point that I think the pharmacy question is not patient-centered enough, I would just rereading it in light of what Joan's comments are and other comments. It's all about the pharmacist. And I think maybe the way to
reframe this without trying to wordsmith anything, is just lead with the patient. What, you know, how do patients achieve the best outcomes for themselves by XYZ with pharmacy? I just think that there has to be, and I think that's going to be important. That isn't a minor editing point, I don't think, because I think that's going to be important to translate that to researchers who are going to be very prone to say, oh, this is all about pharmacists. It's just too easy to make it all about pharmacists. And so I think it has to lead. It's going to have to have a strange reframing, but it has to lead with the outcome for the patient. How do patients achieve the blah, blah, blah? And this is a really big issue, by the way. The other, I mean, we've been talking about this too much, but one of the biggest issues for hospitals, at least I know, is in general, is medication reconciliation. And it's still a conundrum they can't figure out. It's a huge problem. So for hospitals, but obviously for the patients, more importantly, who, you know, do not have a clear understanding of what medications they're on and how they interact when they're discharged from the hospital and how all that comes together, it's just a mess. So I think there's a lot that can be done here. But again, I really would urge us, I think in order to translate what this panel is really looking for from this question, lead with the outcomes that we want.
Okay, time check. We have 50 minutes till we're supposed to end our meeting. I currently have Lisa, Jake, and Susan in that order. I'm going to put out a last call so we have enough time to talk about the other aspects of this question.
Yeah, that is 11:30. It's 20 of 11,
right? We have 50 minutes.
No.
5-0, but the enthusiasm will consume most of it. So, Lisa, Jake, Susan, and last call. So, Leah, you're down. The next person I have is Lisa, actually.
Yeah, and I guess I just want to add mental health to this conversation because I feel like if we're talking about outcomes, shortening that, what I'm interested in is, like, the amount of time it takes somebody to get managed with their medication. Because, like, the way that it works, right, is you get a prescription, you take it to the pharmacy, they have to run it through insurance. You take it, you might be having side effects, you might not be regulated, then you either have to make an appointment, come back in, and then start that loop over again. And I think, like, with lots of primary cares, prescribing antidepressants, anti-anxiety, things of that sort, and the need to really titrate those, find ones that work. The side effect could be suicidal tendencies. There's lots of side effects. Or even, like, thyroid, right? Like, thyroid, there are golden levels of thyroid management and having that loop shortened so that it's not this kind of cumbersome process. That would be kind of the outcome that I'm looking at. I would be kind of interested in is, like, can we reduce the amount of time it takes somebody to get regulated on any number of prescriptions? And I think the thing that this is making me think of was, like, the American Academy of Pediatrics had a number of research projects, and one of them was constipation in children with autism spectrum disorder. It was a patient-driven, it wasn't sexy, it was, like, the least sexy of all the topics, but it was the thing that was super patient-centered where they asked this group of patients what would be the most meaningful thing you could do, and the average child with autism spectrum disorder, it's really common, severe constipation, it takes about a year to get under control. It takes a year, and that has to do with titrating and being creative with the Miralax. It comes down to the Miralax because they have restricted diets and sensory issues and all of that. And what they found is that they were actually able to get it down to 6 weeks. So they were able to get this chronic constipation down under control. And the quality of life where you have an 8-year-old who's incontinent, you know, or who's becoming anxious about going to the restroom, the implication of that being patient-centered was huge. And it came down to a pharmacist working with the family members on a regular basis to titrate adequately. So those are just some kind of ideas about how I think that this could be have a really big impact and the kind of patient-centered outcomes that we're looking for as opposed to the sort of multidisciplinary team thing that we already know about.
Actually, Michael, you're next.
Michael Blanton. I just want to mention a subpopulation that I think is critical, and that is individuals with unknown type 2 diabetes or prediabetes. And you know, when we talk about collaboration, U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has draft recommendations out now to expand diabetes screening. And as we expand diabetes screening and we talk about better use of pharmacists, pharmacists have a lot of training in diabetes, and many of them have taken courses and I think certification in diabetes certification. Right, I took one of those courses as an optometrist, actually. So what I'm saying is I don't know the regulations for pharmacists doing blood tests and getting CLIA certified and those kinds of things, but I just want to mention that subpopulation, and it's an important one.
Okay, I have Jake, Susan, and David, and then we're going to stop this conversation. So if you would proceed in that order, Jake.
Thank you. To go to Penny's question specifically about populations, you can look at the top 10 medical conditions that are affected by MTMs. And so it's diabetes, hyperlipidemia, hypertension, depression, rheumatoid arthritis, HIV, not HIV. That's about 4 of the 5 out of the 10. I'm sorry, it's off the top of my head. So, I mean, those are specific populations that are already being targeted within MTMs that can be looked at. The other thing to bear in mind is that MTMs are typically geared towards Part D plans, so the elder population. But also, before this year, you had to have 2 or more chronic medical conditions, and you're only eligible for 1 MTM in 1 fiscal year. And oftentimes patients said no or patients don't come. And so there's an interesting aspect within the patient-centeredness to this question is that pharmacies offer these services, so patients don't utilize them. So what is it about that they're not utilizing it? Do they not know the impact of what could be happening? Do they not like it? So, I mean, there's some patient-centeredness to that piece of it as well.
So, Penny, I was looking at a combination of medications, so it would go with the chronic diseases, common side effects. You know, in the hospital, for instance, we talk about making sure we use the word side effects to patients and tell them the top 2, not all of them, because then they just think they have all of them. But that would be another area. Continuation of medication. Sometimes patients do have those side effects and they want to stop it, but if the pharmacist says, hey, we know you're going to have this, but in a week or two or a month, it'll be going away. That's another place where it's useful. Correct use of inhalers. I mean, who's teaching these patients how to use their inhalers? Prednisone side effects. Start gaining weight. You stop taking it, but you kind of shouldn't. Should the pharmacy provide education on the front end on that? And, of course, Dan talked about the antibiotic resistance as well. I agree with Doris. I think the community pharmacy or the role of the pharmacist intervention, collaboration, whatever we want to call it, is helpful for the patient. Because I think in the hospital, for instance, in transplant, we're required to have the patient see the pharmacist at least 3 times in the course of getting to transplant. So before they go to transplant, during the transplant process, and after. But a year later, they're going to their community pharmacy. And well, guess what? They call because they get a prescription. They want to know if we think they should take this prescription. Well, it would be great if I could say, you know what? Your local pharmacy can let you know if that combination is a problem. So I think the community part of it is probably where, maybe because I don't see it, but I feel there's a lot of need.
And then one with David.
Mine was actually, Doris, was just a process question, depending around, given the feedback now, what do you foresee kind of the next steps with refining and, you know, what's the plan? I think the panel thinks it's an important topic, but you know, I think there's still some fine-tuning. So.
I would like to defer that to Steve because I think that he has the final say.
Okay. Thanks. We can get this later, but I was just...
Yeah, I think we still have one more through, don't we? Okay, so why don't we want to move to that first so that we can make sure we get input or?
Yeah, no, that's fine, but he was just asking what happens to these questions after.
Oh, yeah. Basically what happens is, and we've done this before, is that, you know, we take the information we've got from you today, and then we have to do staff work to try to articulate, we go back, match it to the, you know, make sure we're sticking with the evidence gaps because we've got a lot of suggestions here, and we go back and make sure those evidence gaps are clear. And then we start, and then we try to look at the articulated interventions that are mentioned to make, you know, to try to determine whether or not all of them are appropriate for comparative effectiveness research based on our criteria of, you know, either in widespread practice or that they do have some evidence behind them, and we're not talking about, you know, pilot projects. as a start for that, and then work through what you said in terms of those outcomes as a basis then to try to put together some concepts that then we can start working internally and then ultimately with the the board.
All right, let's move on to the next question. And actually, this is the topic 4 on the list that was handed out to you. I think that there's some fairly clearly articulated questions here. So just for the benefit of people who are on the phone, I'm going to read them. The first question is, what is the comparative effectiveness of different screening approaches to prevent suicide? The second is, what is the comparative effectiveness of prevention approaches for people who screen positive for suicidality? The third is, what is the comparative effectiveness of alternative strategies to minimize suicidality among teens? And the specific strategies are like universal prevention programs, targeting at-risk students for primary prevention, a combination of primary and secondary prevention compared with no intervention. And then the fourth is, what is the comparative effectiveness of different cognitive and behavioral therapeutic modalities for the at-risk population, which I think is a little bit different question. So, I mean, maybe it's not my prerogative, but I think it would be helpful to focus on the first 3 questions first. So,
all right, so let's take them in the order presented, which would be to start the conversation about screening approaches. And again, Penny, could you rephrase the question with respect to screening? Do you want to hear people talk about specific screening in general, populations? How do you want to? What specific feedback do you want from the advisory panel?
Well, actually, of those 3 questions, the first is focused on screening. The second is focused on once they've screened positive interventions, and the third is really focusing on these fairly different kinds of approaches for a specific population. I think it's the first 2 questions that I'd like a better understanding of whether people feel it's important to focus on screening or the effectiveness of preventive approaches for people who screen positive. So let's start there.
So primary prevention. Anne, Elisa, are you up again? Or okay. Anne, and then Annie, please.
Yeah, this is Ann Sales. When Ellen and I talked about presenting these and thinking about the questions yesterday, we both kind of looked at the questions and said we can't really prioritize among them. But I think I and both of us, we just had a quick sidebar conversation about this, are kind of leaning towards the screening, the question focused on the teen population as potentially the most viable. Although, as I've been thinking about this and thinking in the broader context of other conversations we've had about other topics, I really wonder if this topic might not be best served by considering a workshop focusing on it, because it is, I think, all the points that have been made about its complexity, about the way it reaches across the entire spectrum of organizations and levels of systems, the interface with non-healthcare systems as well, suggests to me that although we could take a sort of single approach and say, we think teens are the highest risk group and we should focus there and focus on screening and prevention approaches, I really wonder if we wouldn't be better served stepping back a bit.
Annie?
Yeah, great point, Dan. I actually agree, and I think it's a difference whether we do this in a healthcare setting versus a school. And quite frankly, I kind of like the idea of the school. And I think if you're going to do screening, if you're going to do prevention and screening, you have to do the intervention. Like, you can't just do one and then. And I think that this is perfect, knowing this adolescent population fairly well, to have it be some sort of web-based or some sort of happy thing. And having a work group would really help inform that. But I don't think this is going to be a traditional way of doing things. I think this is a tech-savvy population that's coming up, and we have to meet them where they're at. And where they're at is right here. But I love this topic, and I think we have to do it across the continuum of screening, identifying, and what the intervention is.
Joan?
Joan, your mic, please.
I do agree with Annie there, because when I think about patient centeredness, that is where the students, the kids are. I think it will have an impact on the health system. I think that these strategies, I don't understand why there's no topic within here about the medical system. I don't know why we can't have among the strategies something about something that involves the clinicians, that there isn't some kind of medical screening possible. You know, why does it have to be only alternative, you know?
Yeah. I think that a lot of the kids, if you're a healthy kid, my kids see the pediatrician once a year now, but thank goodness they're healthy, but they're in school all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just don't know, given insurances and co-pays and having to bring my kid in because they might look a little sad, I'm probably going to reach out to the teachers at the school, to the counselor, and to the school nurse, where my kids spend a good proportion of their time. Does that make sense, Joan?
That's true. I think that insurance could make a big effect. Okay. I really do think that it could be quite a good example, it would be very informative.
Joan, I just want to respond to you as well. This is Doris Font. There was in the issue brief the point about primary care not doing a good job of screening. So, again, we do need a nice, crisp topic, but I think your point is well taken. With kids, we certainly need to meet them where they're at. We're adults. Not quite sure where it's at is there, perhaps the place of employment, certainly where they travel socially. But I wouldn't discount too far their primary care providers as well, because we have evidence that they're not doing as comprehensive a job as they could. All right. Alan, you're next.
I just want to amplify what some people have already said. I haven't viewed these questions as being necessarily mutually exclusive. And I agree with Anne that the third question, which is the comparative effectiveness of alternative strategies to minimize suicidality among teens, is probably the most important one. Well, within that context, I agree with Annie and with others that you need to include screening and you need to have a test in different settings. So somehow we need to combine those into what might be a larger question, but you could put out a call for proposals which would have a multiplicity of different research projects that might focus on different parts of that larger question. As for the last question, the more I think about this now, I'm wondering whether that's something that is better dealt with in another advisory panel, in the diagnosis and treatment options panel, rather than here, because it looks more like a comparative study of clinical modalities, and it might be better suited for that group than as a health systems issue so much.
Yeah, Alan, your comment reminds me of the Espert model. Let's don't just create unless you're going to intervene. Susan, you're next.
So I agree with everyone. I think Doris is right. I think primary care are not doing a great job of identifying these teens. So it depends on kind of the environment you're in, because, like, for instance, my son has been seeing the same pediatrician for over 10 years. So I think if he, you know, when we go in, she asks about his grades. So if one year I tell her he's getting A's and the next year I tell her he's getting C's, that puts a red flag in her mind. So I think we still need the primary care piece in that. I also think we need definitely the school piece, in the sense that, for instance, in our county, we have a social worker for our school. In addition to our guidance counselor for each grade, we have social workers. And if there's a problem with your child, you call the guidance counselor, who then calls the social worker. So I think the role of the school is obviously, from an implementation standpoint, will be very, very useful here. And then from a device standpoint, you know, I have a 17-year-old. He's in the house. He doesn't talk to me, but he will text me for 30 minutes. And so, again, when we talk about interventions, this is maybe a way that if they're having concerns, if they can press an app and text someone and say, hey, I feel like I don't feel so good today. My parents are going through a divorce. My friend just killed himself. You know what I mean? Where they can text and someone talks to them via text, that may be something they want to do. Because he'll say to me later on when I come on and say, hey, how are you? I just talked to you, Mom. Because his perception is he's talked to me for 30 minutes via text. So, you know, I think we need the whole pie here, because that is
I think if we leave out the primary care, we're going to leave out kids that do go for whatever reason. So I just want to be careful. But I think the school piece is implementation-wise is huge.
Jerry, can I have you next?
Thank you. I think what's interesting is if PCORI does comparative effectiveness research and we're debating what location we should be doing this in, wouldn't that be the research question?
Nice and succinctly stated. Dan, I have you next.
I've been continuing to mull over this whole issue of patient-centeredness because it's come up in outcomes in all of these, even the ones that there's clear, you know, almost unanimity on. And so as we're talking about what the questions should be, maybe they should be driven by what the outcomes should be and have that guide what the questions say. Because I even though I don't fully understand some of the things that Lisa said, I see the wisdom of them, and I really am trying to understand it. And hopefully, if Lisa's still here after this meeting, we can chat. But I think by what best focuses questions is the ultimate goal of what we're trying to do, and those are the patient outcomes. And so it's going to take some time, but I think if we can think about how for all of these things to start with the patient outcomes and have that guide the phrasing of the questions, I think that could be very helpful.
Michael.
I just want to amplify, again, the need, I think, for a workshop on this, again, because it brings in, that would help bring in the other sectors, I think. And I agree that with children, especially teens, we should look at the expanded definition of wellness and maybe even the World Health Organization definition of wellness that really would highlight the need to bring in other avenues here. And, you know, we all know that children deserve that kind of overall well-being in order to succeed in life. And the other thing I want to mention is that we shouldn't, just like Ann said, this is just the tip of the iceberg. We need to look at all of those things that are listed there on the early stages of this because those are the important characteristics that need to be, any screening we do needs to be highly sensitive enough to pick up those issues.
I have Jamie and then Alan, and then I think we need to move on. So last call, if you've got a burning comment. Otherwise, we'll go to Jamie first and then Alan.
Just a really quick comment. I think, you know, we're talking about schools. It's not necessarily part of the healthcare system, but a lot of kids do get their health care at school, and we should bring the school nurses, you know, and that conversation and that stakeholder group into the conversation too.
Thank you. And Alan?
Two quick points, building on the last one, Jamie and Michael. I just want to sort of reinforce the notion that we should look beyond just the healthcare system per se and recognize what Michael had said earlier about there being other social systems, what Jamie and others had said about schools. So I would hope that we would look at, you know, strategies that would deal with the prevention of suicide that would take into account things that are external to the healthcare system but play an important role in preventing suicide. And then secondly, I'd like to reinforce what Anne had suggested about having a workshop with people who are working specifically in this area and getting them to focus a little bit more on the questions and giving more guidance to PCORI as to how you could, you know, frame the questions in a way that will yield the best possible research project.
All right. Quick little organizational question to the group. We had also wanted to discuss refining our Tier 3 IHS questions. I think the more time-sensitive issue is to continue to work on refining these topic questions, unless you feel like you're done. But I'm not even sure 25 minutes is adequate conversation for the Tier 3 questions, the review questions. So we can certainly take that off the agenda and encourage you to comment via email. And then continue that conversation between meetings. Then we'll have a little more time to make sure our CER questions are as well thought through as we can be. Are you all right with that, Steve, or did you want to take a different tack? Any concerns about that? All right, hearing none, then I'm going to ask Penny to take over again. And is there anything else you'd like to talk about with the suicide prevention topic as far as the questions are concerned?
Actually, what I would like to do is just remind people of some of the things that we didn't discuss, if we could do that. So a couple of things that we didn't discuss with the dental caries, I did get a strong sense from the group that people thought this was an important topic, but it was not framed appropriately, and that specifically the focus on the dentist may not have been the appropriate focus. So I think we do need to take that back, and we need to refine that and bring that back to the group. That's my sense. If I have any dissenting opinions, please let me know. A lot of head nodding. The other thing is that we did not talk about was the traumatic brain injury, and I am getting the sense that there's a lot going on in here, although we were focused on a different population than maybe the VA population. I'm just wondering if this is a topic that maybe we just want to set aside. And so if maybe I could just get a show of hands of how many people feel this is an important topic to carry forward. Okay, so it looks like it's over half of you feel like it's an important topic to carry forward. So we'll keep that percolating. The other thing that I wanted to let you know is that there are several topics that we had thought were very important topics that were put into the pipeline, and because the briefs weren't of high enough quality, we didn't send them forward to you. I just wanted to let you know what they are. One is looking at long-term care of elderly living in the home. The other is specifically looking at palliative care. And then the other is looking at different residential settings for, hold on just a second, I have that, for the frail elderly. Is that correct? Hold on just a second, I have it in front of me.
I have it as well. Compare the effectiveness of different residential settings, for example, assisted living facilities, nursing homes, in caring for patients with functional impairments.
For functional impairments, okay. So, anyway, I just wanted to let you know that those are topics that will probably come back to you. And pain is another one that will probably come back to you. So I just wanted to get another sense of the two topics that we thought we focused a little bit more on. My takeaway for the first topic is that it potentially, which is the pharmacy services, could potentially sit well within the pragmatic trial funding announcement. We need to know better details about what we're comparing, the comparative questions which you raised, Dan, in order to decide where's the best place for this. But that might be a good place for it. And the other thing that I heard about the suicide prevention is that we should not probably move that forward in any particular venue right away, that it's best probably to convene a workshop and really focus on better refining this with a broader group of people that are outside of the traditional healthcare system as well. So let me just stop there.
This is Ann Fales. I just want to add to that. I think, yes, we do need to bring in people who represent those broader systems. But I think also think we have to bring in experts in suicide prevention. Dan and I both have said we are not. And so that's really different from some of the other topic briefs where we've had some considerable expertise around the table. I think it's critical that there be a broad discussion but include experts in the topic area so that they can help inform what's already known about outcomes, what kind of measurement opportunities are there. There are a whole bunch of things I couldn't even begin to think about.
Penny, Ms. Dorisloss, as someone who is still sort of understand the funding mechanism. I mean, at some level, I just feel like, well, it's the staff and the DOG decision. I mean, whatever you guys think is fine, as long as the research at the other end is usable. Why do you think the pharmacy issue is better for a pragmatic study? Could you just sort of reinforce that your thinking, share your thinking on that, and reinforce our understanding of the different funding strategies?
From what I've heard from people, there's been a lot of little small studies done in this area, but that potentially it was ripe for much larger studies, and that this might be a good mechanism. So that's what I heard back from people. Other people can comment.
Dan, it's really hard to know without, there's certain kinds of studies that can, large studies that can be done actually relatively inexpensively if they're based primarily on available data in electronic health records, for example, which this might be largely. So I just don't know how to think about this until I have a better idea. But you did suggest, Penny, that we should defer that until we get a better idea. So I think that's, I'm comfortable.
It's also possible that it could fit in both places, in the broad funding announcement as well as in the pragmatic, so depending upon how we structure the question. I think, Lisa?
This is Lisa Rosignol. I would just like to reiterate what Ann said. I would specifically, if you did a work group, I'd like to encourage that you reach out to the Native American or American Indian community and have somebody from that community that works in suicide prevention, because I think the fact that they're three times more likely than any other group of at all to commit suicide, I think you would need somebody who had expertise in either the genetic, cultural, or other influences for that area, and that might help kind of determine that aspect. But I just don't think, I think a work group is a good idea, but I just think you cannot have it without a member representing that community.
Okay, that's very helpful. The other thing that I wanted to mention is clinical decision support. I think there's a lot of interest in potentially the intersection with the Cornet on that particular topic. I think we probably will have them come to our next meeting or something. So I think we'll need to go back and talk with them about that. And then in terms of the NICU topic, my understanding is that potentially what we've got available, just our regular funding announcements, may be already encouraging work in this area. I don't know.
Well, none of our funding announcements encourage specific work in this area. And the question is this another potential area where possibly, given that you know, there is relatively a reasonable evidence base around some of these models, whether the notion of some of these head-to-head comparisons of these different approaches is something that would be of interest, and if so, that's the kind of thing that could tend itself towards the large pragmatic study option.
Michael?
On that issue, I thought that we were talking about maybe looking at it as a disease as a disparity issue, since there are certain problems in rural areas as opposed to urban, and also amongst socioeconomic status. So I thought maybe we were going to revisit that with a combined approach, but I don't know.
Yeah, you're right.
Yes,
so Penny, I apologize. My mind was a little distracted when you were talking about some of the other topics, the ones that we hadn't brought here. The one that really clicked was the one about comparing different types of living arrangements for frail, older adults, functional disabilities. I just want to say about that 20 years ago, there was a large wave of research in that area. That was one of the first projects I was involved with when I was starting off as a health services researcher. Uniformly, they could not find a difference between the different kinds of settings. I just want to say that because the study we did was funded by the John A. Hartford Foundation. It was not a massive study, but we collected a lot of data and went directly to residents, including residents with mild cognitive impairment, which is a very major issue that you encounter when you work in that population. And we could not find a difference. So, I mean, there were some slight edges on certain kinds of things. We looked at quality of life extensively and asked people a lot about their perceptions. And so much of it came down to individual trajectories and stories and what they preferred. And so I just caution that that's a topic area that could be, I don't know how much yield you'd get.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment that in that area, it's exactly the topic brief was saying exactly what you said, and it was because of the messiness and the inability to specify research questions that would move us ahead because of the kinds of factors that you're talking about. So I think your comment is well taken.
Jamie?
Just a quick process question. For the large pragmatic trials, are all the topics that we've talked about and put forward and they're listed on there now, do they stay on and we're building on that list for future cycles, or is there a point where something that we put on, for the first cycle is going to come off the list of priorities?
My sense is that everything that we talked about stays on the list. Even when we got to the traumatic brain injury, there's over half the people felt like that should stay on the list. So I do think we're looking for more priority topics to come from our group into the pragmatic trial, so all of these are potentially candidates.
Yeah, I say that, but, this is an evolving process. That's after we do, two or three rounds of this, I think there may be a kind of a reassessment of, some of the topics that are on the list. And I think that's why it's really important if we want to try to have a place on that we do try to take the opportunity seriously from this group to put priority topics in that announcement.
Anne and then Lisa.
I just want to say I think that's a great idea, but I'd like to encourage us to go all the way back when we do that because some of us were talking about this last evening. Things have evolved so much. The panel has evolved. The understanding of process, the CORI as an organization has evolved. There are way more staff in this area than there were when we started. I think it would be worth at least doing a run-through of, the first initial set of topics all the way through rather than saying we'll go back to the three or four in the last round or something like that.
Lisa?
Yeah, I just since this is my last one, I just feel the need to comment that and on the record that I in no way support any type of studies or support or money going to residential programs for people with disabilities. I just think that the ship has sailed on that one, and there is difference in settings, but there are also huge social, psychological, and abuse issues with residential centers that have been shown over and over again. And so I just want to make that really clear that I'm adamant against residential programs for people with disabilities.
Joan?
Well, I agree with Lisa definitely that, the alternative to residential programs is care at home in some variation of care at home. And I don't remember that we did consider a topic of long-term care of the elderly at home. And I don't think it should be restricted to elderly either. But I would strongly recommend that we look at that one. And I do think that you may not even be looking at all the stakeholders or maybe considering all the stakeholders you should when you look at that one. Because there are a lot of community, and there's a lot of movement in the community to create new options for people to live at home. And it certainly is what the patient wants, as far as we can tell. The other one is pain. I remember when we discussed pain, and it was, I'm sure it's a topic that everyone cares deeply about, and we want to see PCORI do something about studying pain and the effectiveness of intervention from the patient's perspective. And so I really urge you to bring that back up very quickly. And brain injury, I think we were just at the tip of the iceberg. I think that one does need workshops because I don't think that we have enough expert information about what patients feel or what happens, what patients think about their brain injury issues, you know, about their injury. That's my comment.
Leah?
Well, I guess it's also my last meeting, so I'll throw in my last speech. I don't know where we are. Maybe I should have seen this and didn't. But I think that Corey was going to have conversations with ARC about patient safety research and how that was going to be integrated and what role, if any, Corey could play compared to effectiveness around systematic interventions to improve safety in hospitals or elsewhere. I mean, I would be remiss to come from leapfrog and not say this is a massive issue. This is one in four people are harmed by admission to a hospital. So it's an elephant in our living room when we're talking about health systems. So I hope that continues and that you get on that as fast as possible. Thanks. And there isn't enough research on it, that much I know.
Last call. Anything else that you folks want to close with, staff?
Yeah, just a couple of things. First of all, unfortunately, Leah was not at dinner last night and had an opportunity for my roasting. But I do just want to say in a very short statement, you're very fortunate, you. But how much we really appreciate her service on this panel over the last 2 years. It is just really emphasized for me the importance of the purchaser perspective in all this, because much of what we talk about ultimately has to reflect itself in benefit design and in decisions that purchasers make about how this healthcare system evolves and how it works. And it's been especially wonderful to have her here because of her, I mean, she's got a career of commitment to the employee, the patient, and the quality of care, the need for having the right care to improve their quality of life inside and outside the workplace. And I just want to say how much I appreciate your service to our panel, and I hope that we can get the purchase perspective as we continue to move forward and keep that a real important part of our panel's work. The second thing I just want to mention, we were talking about this a minute, and I don't know all the procedures about this, but, you know, moving to the next meeting, we are losing one of our chairs. You know, I think it would be appropriate to ask if people are interested in serving in that role to let us know. Ultimately, these appointments are done, I believe, through the board. I mean, I think the board ultimately does, yeah, the selection committee does this, but without some interest from people, it's kind of hard. We do need some nominees from the panel for that. I'll double check that. But if you have an interest in that, please let us know so that we can figure out, you know, how that process works. Because I wasn't here when this was initially created, but I just, when you're talking, it reminds me we have an open spot here, so we probably need to fill it.
So I'll just say a few words in our wrap-up. Great meeting. We filled a day and a half. I think we could have filled more. I always feel a little bad when I have to be a timekeeper. You all have watches on your wrists or on your smartphones, and yet I sometimes feel like, all right, let's remember collectively what time it is to move us forward, and that's always sad to curtail the conversation. But I'll say, again, what I said before, even for those of you who are leaving the advisory panel at this time, the staff is very, very, very open to hearing from you. Don't hesitate to do that. I know we all go back to our day jobs and probably forget about some of the things that are open items. I do keep a running tally. Trent ran through that yesterday. I'll bring that up in our conversations that the chairs have with staff in between meetings. But to summarize the meeting very briefly, and I would welcome anyone to jump in and insert what they think, is also important in summary, but we did start out with seven issue briefs coming into this meeting, and we're going to move forward, at least initially, with further development on the role for the pharmacist in improving health outcomes, and also probably move forward with a work group on refining the question of suicide and specifically suicide prevention. We also talked about our research prioritization criteria. We tried to apply them and use them and noted that there were a few things that could be improved. So that's what I called a tier three criteria. I think we'll make an effort to make sure that the slides Leah referred to this morning are available to everyone. But you'll see that these questions, these research prioritization questions, come in at the tier three level. Please do, I'm sure we'll get some emails from Lauren and others on the PCORI staff saying, please do comment on this. Make sure that they really address the unique role that we as panelists in the healthcare systems area want to capture in our prioritization. The next meeting that we have in the past, not that we've got a whole lot of precedent, but we've got a couple years under our belts now, is typically in spring, and we'll be very, very sad. And I just want to give one last shout-out of thanks both to the folks who are in the room who will be with us in the springtime and those who aren't. So that is Andrew Adams, Leah Binder, Alan Cohen, Trent Haywood, Tiffany Lang, Annie Louise Connor, and Lisa Rosignol. So thank you so much for your participation. I know that I could add to Steve's roasting how each one of you has uniquely contributed, and if you really want to know, I'd be happy to have that conversation afterwards with you because my flight doesn't leave till 3, so I have plenty of time. But everyone here plays a wonderful note in this orchestra that we're all trying to pull together to improve healthcare systems. So thank you, thank you, thank you. Please tap on people just like you, or even yourselves, to submit a nomination or self-nomination to continue in the panel. I had a conversation with Judith last night where it became aware to me, correct me if I'm wrong, staff, but my understanding is that people on the panel now can put themselves in for another term. So if you want to do that, please do consider that. I think that nominations are still open at this time. And other than that, I would just say it has been a fabulous meeting. I look forward to continuing the conversation with all of you in some form or another as we try to improve healthcare systems. Annie, last comment. I don't want to have the last comment, but I'll
I actually don't want the last comment because this is a question. I do not have our next meeting on my calendar. And I'm feeling a little anxious about this. Have we got a meeting scheduled?
I'm going to have to defer to Hannah. Oh, she's shaking her head. I know she sent out a doodle poll, but it's not going to be until May, whereas it's been in April in the past. But because of the application process for new panelists, it's not going to be until May. And I know Hannah's working on a doodle poll to poll current panelists.
No, and I understand. I'm feeling a little pressure and anxiety because my spring is doing it fast.
I'm just going to comment as well. So I did send out the doodle poll, but because of the uncertainty with the recruiting and who's going to actually be on the panel, it's not finalized with, like, Emma and that group. So
it's not finalized, but somehow through some sort of magic that might have been uniquely mine, I have a hold on my calendar for May 27th, 28th, and 29th.
Right. That's the targeted period that I sent out, so if you want to put a hold on that time period, that's what we're targeting, but it's not finalized. So. Lauren, do you know when it will be finalized?
So with that being held, and this is run through our science office because we like to bring the groups together as much as possible, so it'll be another series of meetings just like this event was. But so you can hold those 3 dates. My guess would be, so applications come in February 6th and shortly after that. So it would be within, no. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure. Okay, well, let's, that's, thank you for the feedback and we'll just land on a date.
Truly, there's no pride of chairmanship here. I don't have to have the last word. So if anyone has any parting comments, please do say them. Raise your table tents. Otherwise, Leah, please.
I just wanted to say how impressed I was with the quality of the discussion that you all have here, and it gives me a much deeper appreciation for the work that goes on at the advisory panel. So thank you for letting me join you.
I think I have a much narrower focus and a much more broad focus than many of you on the advisory panel, so that was very interesting for me to learn and for me to think about. So I think of the nexus of, I think you all have the hardest job because improving health systems, when the modifier for the scientific research that we do is patient-centered outcomes, is difficult, and it's not well-defined, and it's not as easy. So, but I do think of patient-centered outcomes as the modifier for the research that I believe PCORI was mandated to do, and that we are, at first, a comparative clinical effectiveness research center that must focus on patient-centered outcomes. And so that's the lens that I bring to the table. And so when I'm thinking about the briefs, I start there. So and I'm just one voice of 21, but that's where I start. I really thought a lot about who the right resource to design the question is, because we struggle at the same level you're struggling here with the questions. What became clear to me is I think it might be helpful to think through with staff about the outcome, because I also find focusing on the end game first much easier to back into other things. And because of the makeup of all of our advisory panels not necessarily being the experts, but what I heard loud and clear is all of you sharing, well, I think we have other people to check in with in designing the questions. But I do think that you could have a very strong and consensus or majority viewpoint about what the outcomes are. So if you think about the PCOTS model, the population intervention, comparator outcomes and timing, starting with outcomes first, and then if there are other modifiers that you guys have a strong sense of, like the teen one today, that could be input. But then if there's others that you don't have as strong of a sense of, that would be great feedback, I think, to hear through staff and at the board level of, okay, the topic is important and we know what the outcome we want for this study is. We're not really sure of the exact comparator, because I think sometimes we get hung up on the question that comes to us and we think that's not quite right for a variety of reasons, but it wasn't the topic or even perhaps the outcome that was the issue. So just some reflections. Thank you. Thank you very much for allowing me to participate.
Okay. Alan, did you have a comment?
Thank you, Steve. I just want to say, as I cycle off the panel, that this has really been an incredible experience for the past 2 years. When I reflect back to the very beginning, I think the only staff member that was here might have been Alex. And I might not have been the very, very beginning.
Lauren.
Okay, it was one of you. But, you know, goes back to Chad and Lynn, and we had a host of different people come through. But what I wanted to say, first of all, is thank you to all of the members of the panel. I learned a lot from each and every one of you, and I think we had some really good discussions. They were stimulating discussions. We didn't always agree on issues, but I want to thank you for the collegiality that everyone displayed. I think everyone really respected the viewpoints of others in the room. And I want to thank the staff. In particular, all the folks who come through in those 2 years have done a superb job. I want to thank Steve particularly for his leadership. And I think Penny is a great addition to the team. I always tell my students when they produce these overblown PowerPoint presentations that sometimes less is more, but in this particular case, more is more. And there you have it, more or less. But just in closing, I want to say thank you to everyone. It really has been a wonderful experience from my perspective, and I wish the panel and the staff all the best in moving forward in the future.
Okay, for those of you on the phone, this concludes our webinar. Thank you.